from Social Service .SG, I am Jing Yao, co-hosting today's episode and this mini-series with Isaac. Singaporeans go to the polls on September 1st, 2023 to elect our new president. We choose from three candidates: former Senior Minister and Deputy Prime Minister Tharman Shanmugaratnam, former Chief Investment Officer of Sovereign Wealth Fund GIC, Ng Kok Song, and former CEO of NTUC Income, Tan Kin Lian. An estimated 300,000 to 400,000 Singaporean youth, or about 15% of the electorate, will be voting in the presidential election for the first time. In the lead-up to polling day, in this mini-series, we speak to three first-time voters, all of whom are students, about their thoughts on the presidential candidates, the institution of the presidency, as well as the issues and considerations they are prioritizing. In the show notes, if you are interested, we provided some resources for additional information and readings about the presidency. We've also linked the other episodes in the PE 2023 mini-series. Today, in the final episode of our three-part mini-series, we have 24-year-old Amir, a student at UNUS and the National University of Singapore. He is part of CAPE, but speaks in his personal capacity in this episode. This was recorded on August 22nd, 2023.
Thank you so much, Jinyao. I'm a big fan of the podcast, so I'm really excited to be here. I'm Amir, I'm 24. I'm currently studying law and global affairs at Yale NUS and NUS Law. I'm part of a team involved with CAPE, the Community for Advocacy and Political Education. So for those of you who don't know, check us out on Instagram. On the side, I volunteer with Ubercharga, which is a nonprofit that provides counseling for the queer community. And I used to work with kids in the rental flats in the Bedok Chai Chee area. So that's a bit about my background.
Yeah, and I should also mention it's good timing as well, because I think three years ago, we had your predecessors on who were running CAPE. And then, so it's a slightly dated episode, but tell us about CAPE, right? What is CAPE? A little bit of what you do. And we'll also link both the episode and the Instagram page on in the show notes too.
Sure, thank you so much. So for those of you who don't know, CAPE is a non-partisan, informal collective, but basically just a bunch of youth from NUS and Yale NUS. And we try to fill the gap in terms of political education to provide academic analysis that is still accessible. I think it's been about 8 years. And so fun fact, I actually decided to come to Yale NUS because of CAPE. And so CAPE has always just been this beacon. And I think it was really the first in the space of putting out infographics on Instagram. And yeah, so it's been quite a journey. But I would like to say that whatever I say, here's my personal views, and the CAPE as an organization is sort of independent in that way. But yeah.
Gotcha. And we chatted a little bit before this, and this is not your first time voting. You did vote in GE 2020, though that was under very different circumstances with the pandemic at its height and so on and so forth. But how do you feel about voting in the first presidential election this time around?
Well, honestly, it's both exciting and also underwhelming. So it's exciting because voting it's a sacred right as a citizen. And in Singapore, it's really one of the few ways you can influence tomorrow. And I sort of see every vote as a statement. Now, whether it's a statement of support, of anger, of hope. But if you look far and wide, there are many instances where citizens cannot vote freely without fear of violence or repercussion. So it's an honor and a privilege of being a citizen. Underwhelming, because I think this presidential election is not yet geared up. We're talking on the 22nd of August, but it also seems like a foregone conclusion that Mr. Tharman would win. And I think we're also in this weird situation where a lot of people are questioning what is the importance of a president and what really does their vote mean. So as we go through that process of learning who we're voting for and what that means, we sort of increase interest, but we are at a state where there is a little less enthusiasm than last time. Yeah,
it's a bit interesting. I mean, you mentioned about people questioning the relevance of a president. Interesting thoughts about voting. I'll come to that later. So I just want to ask you first, what are your thoughts about the candidates this time around? Who has made the biggest impression on you?
So Tharman is obviously a standout character. He's a known entity. And for me personally, he's someone I think I'll vote for. And obviously you have the standard reasons. He's really smart. He's very well accomplished. But for me, there were actually two incidents that really cemented him as someone who is special, who's unique. So I'm not sure how many of your listeners will actually remember, but in 2016, during the National Day rally, our Prime Minister had a mini health incident. And I remember feeling shaken for the first time. And I remember only feeling certain times, like when they had a little India riot, like where you start questioning the certainty of tomorrow. I remember watching my parents and we were all shocked. The camera panned from him to the audience. And we were just like, what's going to happen? What's going on? And it wasn't till Mr. Tharman came on, I think it was Channel 5 back then, and he said, listen, everything's okay. The PM's okay. No need to worry. And even then, there was this split second realization that if, let's say, touch with something happened to Prime Minister Lee, we had SM Tharman. He was going to come in, and no matter what, there was stability. And that sort of was some, he's a unique politician that way. The second sort of memory or sort of image I have of him, which is why I really am very happy to vote for him, is there was this image of him at a grassroots event. I think he was watering some plants. It was with a bunch of kids. And then I think the next image was him just like playfully pouring water on kids. And I guess it's that sincerity, it's that kindness, it's that warmth that, yes, all politicians strive to exude, but Mr. Tharman just has it in him. So I think he's a great candidate. That's not to say that I don't think the other candidates are great, and I could go into an explanation of different candidates and what I think about them, if that might be useful.
Yeah, yeah, sure. I mean, what are your thoughts about, I guess, the other two candidates, Mr. Ng Kok Song, Mr. Tan Kin Lian, but also interested to hear from you for about Mr. George Goh, because he did not receive a certificate of eligibility. Yeah, what are your impressions of them?
I think many Singaporeans are a bit disappointed that Mr. George Goh did not qualify. And I think, truthfully, a lot of Singaporeans think that the qualifying criteria is unnecessarily stringent. So let's think for a second that the Minister of Finance or the Prime Minister don't have to meet the same requirements and they have greater control over the reserves. We are also a nation of very successful politicians who began with very different expertise. Our foreign minister was an eye surgeon, and I think he's been a great foreign minister. Our Minister of Defense is a doctor, not a soldier, but he still has that gravitas and respect. So we, and if you remember, our Minister of Health was an engineer. We are a nation of politicians who are capable. And so artificially setting a criteria, I'm not really sure what they were trying to argue. Maybe it was about protection of the reserves, but that sort of becomes a bit shaky when you realize the president doesn't have all that much control over the reserves. So I think the Presidential Election Commission, the PEC, had a good reasoning. I think another professor suggested that if, let's say, it accepted Mr. Goh, what then if another candidate had 500 million companies with a $1 paid-up capital? Would that cumulatively count as meeting the criteria? So I think they had to be stringent because the law is the way it is. We can question why the law is the way it is, but I think that eliminated a candidate who would push the conversation further because he really is out of the establishment, self-made man, and he really has his own credibility to him. With regards to Mr.
Before that, I wanted to kind of ask, right, because this is something I said to Isaac as well, and this is my personal point of view, which is he might have been ineligible, but he was in a way the wrong person to make the right point about the elected presidency and its roles and functions. So I guess a way to ask the question would be, let's say he was deemed eligible and was running and today's nomination day, he was one of the four, right? Would that sway, to what extent would that have swayed your decision? Because you did say you're pretty clear for whom you're voting, but would his inclusion have swayed your decision or made it a bit difficult in that sense?
I think, and we can talk about this more later as well, there was a moment in the last election where Jamus changed the conversation. And I think a candidate like George Goh would just change the conversation, and that would fundamentally alter how people viewed the candidates because he would bring pressure to bear on the conversation. I'm not sure necessarily I would have voted for him, but he is useful for clarifying who you would have voted for, simply because he would hold the other candidates to what they're saying in a way that they probably will not hold in the same way. And honestly, if he had run, I think we would see a much more competitive election closer to us in 2011, because then a lot of votes would be split in terms of candidates being similar in certain regards and also dissimilar. So we would have seen maybe a far more competitive election. Personally, as a voter, I don't think it would have swayed me, but I would have been very happy to see how he holds the system to account. That's what a competitive election does. It lets us see where are the gaps, where are the flaws, where are the areas where candidates are less clear and other candidates can flesh that out. It's only through comparison.
Oh, yeah. I mean, sorry, we cut you off a bit there, I guess. Yeah. Just quickly, your thoughts about the other two candidates, the ones who are running?
Yeah, so Mr. Ng Kok Song, I think he really is a pleasant surprise. It's really strange. You have such a high-profile man who just comes back out of, like, oblivion because nobody really knew him until he stepped forward. I think his argument that he's independent is really a bit weak because he was a senior leader at GIC. And he was Lee Kuan Yew's personal meditation coach. And I think recently in a podcast, he mentioned that he had frequent meetings where he had to present before Mr. Lee Kuan Yew. So yes, he's not affiliated with the PAP, but he's part of the establishment. And I think when voters consider that, that's really the shades between him and Mr. Tharman are getting lesser and lesser. And so I think I give him points for acknowledging, you know, what is the proper role of the president, because unlike other candidates in the race, they have accidentally misunderstood or misstated what a president does. I will say, and this is, so in run-up to our conversation, I've been asking around, and I think interestingly, his bid to make his fiancée more central to his bid, unfortunately, I think has polarized voters, partly because of her age, partly because of her previous Canadian nationality. But I think in recent memory, Singapore's president's partners have been really behind the scenes, quiet forces of support. And I think the intentional choice to make her part of the campaign is valid because our partners do hold us up in moments of crisis. But it really also added on this question of, oh, she will be the co-leader in a way, and her picture will be in every classroom across the nation. And is that something we want? And so I think that has shifted the conversation in a way that maybe he didn't intend. So that's my thoughts on Mr. Ng Kok Song. Regarding Mr. Tan Kin Lian, he's an interesting candidate. And I think he's not as eloquent in English as he is in Mandarin. And I think that has affected what people think of him. He lost points when he asked George Goh to step aside if they both get qualified, because I think George Goh reframed that and sort of say, you know what, this is a serious contest. Let's not just ask people to drop out left and right. And I think the trouble now is, again, we're talking on Tuesday, the 22nd of August, a lot of social media posts from his past are coming up. And I think it's going to affect the conversation. We don't know what the fallout's going to be. And I think it really goes to, it sort of helps the electorate also focus. Who is our president going to be? What is he going to represent? And is what Mr. Tan Kin Lian expressed in these social media posts something that we want as a president to say out loud? Maybe common people have this view, but a president needs to be above us all and represent us when some of the stuff he said has been quite disheartening. So I think that may affect his candidacy. Yeah, so I'm not, and I think generally some voters are not taking him as a serious candidate, and his recent revelations are not really helping his credibility. So yeah, I think that's the state of the candidates. I will say again, I think once we have the debate, which I think is sometime next week, it's more a forum, we'll really get to see candidates side by side, and I think voters will have a better chance to really test who they think and believe in.
Right. Yeah, no, thanks for sharing your views on them. I just wanted to, with these thoughts about the candidates in mind, just wanted to go back to what you said earlier. You said voting was a secret right, but some people find it's a bit underwhelming this time around. I've also heard this. People say Tharman is the PAP-linked candidate, so how independent can he be? Mr. Ng Kok Song, also part of the establishment. And Mr. Tan Kin Lian, some people can't bring themselves to vote for him for reasons that you mentioned. And then there's this growing sense among some people, why don't I just spoil my vote? Because I'm not happy with any of the candidates. I want to send a message to say, like, we want more independent candidates, like Mr. George Goh, to qualify. Or we want someone else, not these three, and they want to spoil their vote. What are your thoughts of the utility of this tactic? Do you think it works? Eager to hear your thoughts.
I think it's useful to remember a little bit of history. In 2011, Mr. Tan Cheng Bock lost by 0.35% to Mr. Tony Tan, right? And that was a difference of 7,382 votes. Now, in that election, the spoiled or invalid votes was 37,826, which is almost 1.66%. We don't know how many were intentionally spoiled, but that's the critical bit. What separated President Tony Tan from a potential President Tan Cheng Bock was 7,382 votes. If it's a case where we have an election that is landslide and everybody has a right to choose how to vote, your vote or protest will be heard, but not, it won't affect the election. But let's consider an election that is very close, where the difference separating Mr. Tan Cheng Bock, Mr. Ng Kok Song and Mr. Tharman is a few thousand votes, and you are one of those few thousand who spoiled their votes, and it and a candidate that you wouldn't have liked as a second choice got in. I think that pressure is very heavy, and you don't even have to look very far. There's in the US context, and is a bit nerdy, but George Bush lost by Al Gore. George Bush beat Al Gore by 1,784 votes in Florida. That's all it took for him to become president. Donald Trump had 80,000 more votes than Hillary Clinton in three states. And so I think the American context is obviously more polarized, but if the 20 election is any indication, if there is a close fight, those votes do matter. That being said, I think a lot of people are frustrated. A lot of people just see the election as a public holiday and they're happy to take it, but they also want to send a symbol or a message to the powers that be that we aren't happy with the candidates we have. So why not just spoil the vote and have that as our sort of mini protest? Because I think it's also important to remind your listeners that while it's technically illegal not to vote, but the important part is if you don't vote in this election, you get struck off the rolls for the next election. And in order to vote in that election, you would need to go through the extra step of going to the elections department. So don't skip this election. Spoil your vote if you want to, but really consider what happens when the margin is that thin and your vote was part of that small group.
Yeah, I'm glad you described that because that's exactly the process I had to go through because I didn't get to vote in 2020. I was in the US and clearly no one's going to vote in the US at that point in time or travel to an embassy to do that. I guess one of the questions folks might have, besides spoiling your vote, you did use the word protest, right, or mini protest vote. One of the ways folks are framing voting for a candidate like Mr. Tan Kin Lian would be it's a sign of their disaffection for the ruling party in that sense, right? And you also raised this up. In fact, actually, I think one thing that's not surfaced as much besides his post about women in general is his post that is many of his posts that one could argue, and I believe in this as well, that reeks of xenophobia in general, right? The concern there is not necessarily one of it necessarily being just a protest vote, but I guess one of the concerns that are coming up right now is he might actually be speaking to a slice of the population that actually hold those views, right? The crowd from our zone, the crowd of folks who genuinely believe in what he shares, right? And so, you know, it's not really a question. I'm not framing it very well as a question, but what do you think about that trend, right? That him legitimizing some of these views, giving it airtime in mainstream media?
I think it really depends on how he decides to engage with what has come out. If he embraces it and says, and I think generally based on his comments, he seems to be dismissing it. If he embraces it and says, you know what, it doesn't really matter, then I think it is a clear sign to other people who do genuinely, unfortunately, hold these prejudices that, hey, I'm like you, I'm a common man, you know, I demean women, I'm a bit racist, but you know, who isn't? And I think some voters will feel like, yeah, okay, you know what, he's a normal guy. But I think we haven't gotten to the point in Singapore politics where we're so polarized that this group who may find that Mr. Tan Kin Lian is a representation of their views is significant enough to change the election. There is a question, though, that if people who are disaffected and who are against the PAP, who do vote for him, would they unwittingly propel him to success? I think those voters are now contending with the fact that he has this litany of baggage that wasn't there a couple days ago. So a couple days ago, he was just the non-establishment candidate. 2 days in already, he is someone who has said some dubious things. And I think that polarizes it both ways, where people who are thinking, feeling, empathetic people will see, sorry, this isn't someone who should represent us. But here's the interesting thing, right? At the end of the election, if, let's say, he does double down and say, this is my views, the proportion of people who do vote for him is a clear sign that there is this population in Singapore. And that would be a clear number of, oh, maybe there are 20%, maybe there's 10%. And I think that would influence future policies. Maybe other politicians will dog whistle. But I'm hopeful that it's too small a minority to sway, and his comments will dissuade people who aren't very keen on the establishment, but who are smart enough to say, I'm sorry, I cannot vote for you. I'd rather spoil my vote than vote for you.
So, Amir, just, I guess, pivoting away from that, just wanted to ask you, I mean, as part of Kate, I'm sure you're pretty on top of things and all, but how familiar are you with the role and responsibilities of the presidency, how would you describe the presidency as an institution?
I think it's very easy to get into the academic part. Oh, the president under this constitutional can or cannot do this. I will say this. What has dawned on me is that your average Singaporean already knows the president is important, but not powerful. And they don't need to study the constitution. They just have three other presidents to base their ideas on. You have President Halimah, you have President Tony Tan, you have President S.R. Nathan, all wonderful leaders, stable leaders, but people who didn't rock the boat. So there's really a built-in presumption that the president is a figurehead, is symbolic. When you get into the weeds and you understand that, yes, the presidency began as a second key to guard our reserves, but following the 2016 constitutional amendment, the role of a group of people known as the Council of Presidential Advisors, the CPA, these eight people now have a sort of collaborative model with the president, with whom now the president must go to and seek concurrence. If, let's say, for example, the president vetoes a bill that requests to draw down on the reserves, if the CPA votes against him by a simple majority, so that's eight people, five people say, no, Mr. President, I'm sorry, we do need to draw down the reserves, it can go back to Parliament and Parliament can overrule the president. So even the president's veto is not as immediate. People think, oh, you're a president, you can just grant clemency to criminals or convicted people who deserve it. The president can only grant clemency for people who the cabinet refers to the president. So it means the president cannot by himself initiate a clemency motion. Cabinet would need to refer it to the president, and the president then decides. So fundamentally, I think people understand that the president is symbolic. He or she plays a unifying role, is someone Singaporeans will look up to. And I mean, for those of us who remember serving NS, we take our pledge to the president of Singapore. So the presidency is higher than our politics. It's higher than a party. And I think that's what most voters expect in our president.
Mm-hmm. I think you've touched on like something important to remember about the president. They have that custodial role, so on. You've mentioned quite a few of their duties and all, but there's also that ceremonial role. They unite the nation, supposed to be above politics and so on. As a first-time voter, I guess, which one matters more to you, the ceremonial, the custodial, or do you think like it's equal weighted for you?
I think definitely the ceremonial. Custodial, like I said, less so because we understand how the system works, but when you think of someone representing Singapore, going abroad, meeting other foreign leaders, you want someone who's not only competent and articulate, but you want someone who has Singapore's interests in their heart. And I think there are candidates out there who've demonstrated that their service to Singapore demonstrates their enormous skill and ability. And I think just a symbol that we can look up to above politics, even though they have establishment ties. So yeah, ceremonial, I think, mostly.
I don't think you'll disagree with my assessment, but you do not represent the average young voter. They're very in the know. You're very plugged in. You described yourself as being paying attention to all these details, right? So I guess the question here will be, now, how much do you think your friends and family care about the election? You described it today as a foregone conclusion, slightly underwhelming. So what are you hearing from your family and friends?
I think thus far, that's been the surprising thing. It's when I'm pretty sure your listeners would be as plugged in as any one of us. But there is a whole universe of people who are completely not aware that George Goh is no longer part of the race, that Ng Kok Siong used to run NGIC. And I think that helps Mr. Tharman because I've been struggling to try and figure out how do you cut the pie? How do you see who the voters are? In a normal election, you can say, oh, you fall along the spectrum. I think there are the unengaged, there are the engaged voters, and then there are the disengaged voters. Referring more to the youth, which I guess is my representation, is you got a lot of youth who are semi-upset at the system, whatever scandals in the past, whatever sort of long-term animosity towards the powers that be, but they generally are ready to vote for Mr. Tharman. Partly because they don't know anyone else, but also partly because they cannot imagine anybody else. There is a small segment that are supporting Mr. Tan Kin Lian, but I think they do it as a joke, as a sort of, oh, this is someone who would really force the PAP to answer questions, but then they also recognize he doesn't really have a shot at the presidency, and he may not even be the best president. So for the youth voters, I think they are definitely open-minded. And I, like I said, I think the debates will help concretize who they would vote for. I would also think they would be more likely to spoil their votes, because I think members of the older generation who queue and wait do not really want to waste their time and just intentionally make their ballot not count. That being said, the adults I've spoken to have sort of a long-term familiarity with the PAP. They sort of say, oh, they've been around for a long time. Sitharaman, I've known him for a long time. I like him and I'm going to vote for him. And so you don't really hear a lot of conversation about other candidates, partly because they haven't done enough groundwork. And partly, George Goh is very good because he has done a lot of pre-publicity. Unfortunately, it went nowhere. Now it's up for Mr. Ng Kok Siong and Mr. Tan Kim Lian to really sort of say, here's my policy. Well, not even my policy. Here's who I am. Do you like me enough to vote me your president? And I think we will see that. But I think the Mr. Darman has a lot of name recognition, and he's part of, he's been around for 20 years, right? You can't just make 20 years, you can't compare 20 years of experience or and sort of publicity with 2 weeks. That's all the candidates have. And if anyone's able to be swayed in those 2 weeks, I think it sends a very clear message about where voters stand in relation to the establishment.
Yeah, I think, yeah, the political science major in me thinks, yeah, you're right. Throughout elections all over the world, actually one thing that matters the most is name recognition. Like I said, people vote for the face that they recognize, they've seen a lot. Yeah, so I think you're pretty right on that one. I guess one more question from me, and for this, I'm actually going to steal a question from Cape's Post on the elected presidency. And it's a bit weird to ask a first-time voter this, but I'll just ask, do you think the presidency should remain an elected one? Do you want to continue voting for a president? Or do you think we should revert back to an appointed presidency? And some context just for our listeners, I'm sure, Amir, you know all this already, but there's been some experts, political analysts who say the elected presidency is a bit getting a bit contradictory. And I quote from the commission, the Mandan Commission, about the elected presidency. They said they noted the emergence of strains rooted in the unavoidable tension between the president's historical and custodial roles. I guess bottom line is that you have an election because the president needs a mandate to carry out their custodial roles, which is to veto the government's plans if needed. But this brings in an element of politicization into the process for a role that is supposed to be a unifier of the country. So there is that little tension there. So that's the context, I guess, of this question. Yeah, again, eager to hear your thoughts on that.
I think it boils down to what people wanted from the presidency. When we began, an appointed presidency was just normal. President Yusof Ishak was appointed. Nobody questioned it. But then at a certain point, the narrative changed and sort of say, hey, wait a minute, we have a lot of reserves. We need someone to check a profligate government, right? And then suddenly that changed as well. And now, oh, okay, we do have someone to check, but we need to check the checker. And so I think each voter has sort of lost understanding of what should a president do. And I think that's the beauty about our system, that we can have another tomorrow. We can sort of change it. There's no set path. We don't have a constitutional monarch that is hard to replace. We have a president whose powers can be amended by a simple majority. So I think it's a question of what do Singaporeans want? And I think we haven't been afforded that opportunity. The Mandan Commission was done by a series of experts, and they are brilliant people who offered their feedback. But what about the public? What about your average citizen? What do they want from a president? Why not have a public consultation or have a referendum of some sort where people can sort of say, this is what I want in the leader of my country? And I think because we haven't been afforded that opportunity, we are all left sort of in the middle trying to figure out, okay, how do I force fit what I want in a president into the system that I have? And that's where a lot of this sort of reluctance comes in, because it doesn't live up to what we want it to be. And I think that's the key issue.
Originally the plan was to ask you about who you think will win. I think that's really clear in terms of your sharing today. There's something you mentioned as a final question from us that you mentioned at the beginning, which is the, can I frame it, the James Lim effect, right? Something that I think is a really astute observation, in the sense of you framed it in the context of, if Mr. Josh Goh was eligible, it's not definite, but there would have been the chance where he would have changed or shaken up the conversation, right? So I guess as a final question, do you see yourself changing your vote in the final, in the next few days of campaigning? And if so, or if not, what are the events or what are the likely kind of factors that will precipitate that decision or change? Yeah.
I think really the forum, I don't know what to expect because we haven't had a forum since 2011. I think generally the tenor of the contest has been very collegial, has been very kind. They've all been very nice to one another. But I think if a candidate draws blood, in the sense that there are hard questions that maybe Ang Kok Song asks Mr. Tharman that demonstrates that he's willing to not be Tharman-like, that may sway voters. And I will say, even though right now in this stage, Tharman is he's likely to win. And I've spoken to many people who say, confirm, you don't even need to think so hard. But I worry of a race that gets narrow, more competitive, with candidates stealing votes from either side because they appeal to a certain segment of society. And I don't know if I actually want this, but in a case where it's a closer fight, I think we will see more interesting sort of individuals come forward. And I think I'm hoping to see a genuine conversation about what the president does and how this individual can help execute what he thinks the president could and should do, which is, I guess, a non-answer, unfortunately. But let's see what comes in the next 2 weeks.